spiritual ambition, the desire to function as the center of a group, the longing to hear oneself speaking, teaching, lecturing, or writing are often wrongly interpreted by the aspirant as service. The master looks not at a worker's worldly force or status, not at the numbers of people who are gathered around his personality, but at the motives which prompt his activity and at the effect of his influence upon his fellow men. True service is the spontaneous outflow of a loving heart and an intelligent mind. It is the result of being in the right place and staying there. It is produced by the inevitable inflow of spiritual force and not by strenuous physical plane activity. It is the effect of a man's being what he truly is, a divine son of God, and not by the studied effect of his words or deeds. A true server gathers around him those whom it is his duty to serve and aid by the force of his life and his spiritualized personality, and not by his claims or loud speaking. In self-forgetfulness he serves. In self-abnegation he walks the earth, and he gives no thought to the magnitude or the reverse of his accomplishment, and has no preconceived ideas as to his own value or usefulness. He lives, serves, works, and influences, asking nothing for the separated self. When a master sees this manifestation in a man's life as the result of the awakening of the inner light and the adjustment of his karmic obligations, then he sounds out a note and waits to see if the man recognizes his own group note. On this recognition, he is admitted into his own group of co-workers and can stand in the presence of his master. Heart, throat, and eye. Later, when the knowledge here conveyed is assimilated, the aspirant will come to an understanding of the true meaning of the heart, the throat, and the eye, which it is the object of the guides of the race to stimulate into functioning activity at this time. We will therefore consider now, 1. The heart center, the throat center, and the center between the eyes. 2. Their awakening and coordination. 3. To what uses they will be put in the coming world cycle. This subject is of vital importance to the modern aspirant, for the mechanism of the heart, the throat, and the eye, constituting part of the inner structure which he must learn to use, has to be mastered and consciously employed by him before any true creative work is possible. When I use the words creative work, I am speaking esoterically and am not referring to the valuable work done by the artists of the world in their many lines of expression. Their efforts, to the seer, are indicative of an inner stirring, of an inner coordination and a motivated activity which will lead to true esoteric endeavor and to creative work on the subtler planes. I am assuming in the student an elementary knowledge of the vital body and of its four centers, and I am assuming that these seven centers, or lotuses, have, theoretically, a place in his imagination. I use the word imagination with purposeful intent, for until there is knowledge and clear vision, imaginative assumption is a potent factor in bringing about the activity of the centers. Let us, for the sake of clarity, list these lotuses with their petal numbers and their location. Their colors are immaterial at present from the standpoint of the student, for much that has been given out is erroneous or in the nature of a blind, and in any case the esoteric colors are widely different from the exoteric. End of side. 1. The base of the spine, 4 petals. 2. The sacral center, 6 petals. 3. The solar plexus center, diaphragm, 10 petals. 4. Heart center, 12 petals. 5. Throat center, 16 petals. 6. Center between the eyebrows, 2 petals. 7. Head center, 1,000 petals. Next, let the student remember two important facts, which may be regarded as elementary and preliminary, but which nevertheless have to be worked out into conscious realization and become part of the purposed intent of the aspirant's training. It is easy to generalize. It is difficult to realize. It is simple to grasp the informative intellectual data regarding the centers of force. It is most difficult to bring about the rearrangement of the forces flowing through these vortices and to learn to function consciously through the higher centers, subordinating the lower ones. This has to be done also without laying the emphasis upon the form aspect, as is the case in many practices used to vitalize the centers. The two facts of importance are, one, the three centers below the diaphragm, A, base of spine, B, sacral center, C, solar plexus center, which are at present the most potent in average humanity and the most alive, require to be reorganized, reoriented, and to be brought from a state of positivity into that of negativity. Equally, the four centers above the diaphragm, A, the heart center, B, the throat center, C, the center between the eyebrows, D, the head center, must be awakened and brought from a state of negativity into that of positivity. This has to be brought about in two ways. First, by the transference of the positive energy of the lower centers into that of the higher, and secondly, by the awakening of the head center by the demonstration of the activity of the will. The first effect is produced by character building and by the purification of the bodies as used by the soul in the three worlds. The second is the result of meditation and the development of organized purpose imposed by the will upon the daily life. Character building, clean living, controlled emotional reactions, and right thinking are the platitudes of all religious systems and have lost weight from our very familiarity with them. It is not easy to remember that as we live purely and rightly, we are verily and indeed working with forces, subjecting energies to our needs, subordinating elemental lives to the requirements of spiritual being, and bringing into activity a mechanism and a vital structure which has hitherto been only latent and quiescent. Nevertheless, it remains a fact that when the energies, latent at the base of the spine, are carried to the head and are brought via the solar plexus, that clearing house of energy, and the medulla oblongata, to the center between the eyebrows, then the personality, the matter aspect, reaches its apotheosis, and the Virgin Mary, in the individual sense, which is a finite parallel of an infinite reality, is carried up into heaven, there to sit by the side of her Son, the Christ, the soul. When the energies of the sacral center, focused hitherto on the work of physical creation and generation, and therefore the source of physical sex life and interest, are sublimated, reoriented, and carried up to the throat center, then the aspirant becomes a conscious creative force in the higher worlds. He enters within the veil and begins to create the pattern of things which will bring about eventually the new heavens and the new earth. When the energies of the solar plexus, expressions hitherto of the potent desire nature, feeding the emotional life of the personality, are equally transmuted and reoriented, then they are carried to the heart center, and there is brought about, as a result, a realization of group consciousness, of group love, and group purpose, which makes the aspirant a server of humanity and a fit associate of the elder brethren of the race. When these three transfers have been consummated, then an activity transpires in the head center, the ultimate governing factor, and by an act of the will of the indwelling ruling soul, certain happenings take place which we can consider later in our studies. Two, the second fact to bear in mind is that as these changes and reorientations take place, the disciple begins to awaken psychologically to new states of consciousness, to new states of existence, and to new states of being. It will be apparent, therefore, how necessary it is to go slowly in these matters, so that the mental apprehension and ability to reason logically and sanely may parallel the growth of the intuition and of spiritual perception. Many schools are simply forcing schools, prematurely developing the higher faculties and leading the aspirant, if I might express it in mystical language, directly out of the realm of feeling and of desire into that of the intuition, but leaving the intellectual faculties and the mental apparatus totally undeveloped and latent. When this is the case, then, again speaking mystically, an hiatus or a gap occurs in part of the equipment which the soul must perforce use in the three worlds of its endeavor. The interpreting, organizing, understanding mind is unable to play its part. Where there is lack of understanding and of mental ability, there is danger of misapprehension, of credulity, and of wrong interpretation of the phenomena of other states of being. A sense of values will be lacking, and the aspirant will overestimate the non-essentials and fail to grasp the value of the spiritual realities. Energy may pour into the force centers in these cases, but because there is no directing intelligence, it will run riot, and we then have those sad cases which strew the path of occult endeavor and have brought the work of the lodge into disrepute, cases of overemphasized personalities, of superstitious devotees, of credulous followers of leaders, of fanatical unbalanced idealists, and of those warped minds which arrogate to themselves powers which are not theirs. Men and women become swayed by astralism and wander in the veil of illusion, regarding themselves as different from other men, placing themselves upon a pedestal far above average humanity. They fall consciously into the sin of separateness. Add to the above category the cases of sex perversion brought about by overstimulation of the sacral center, the cases of neuroticism and oversensitivity and emotionalism brought about by the premature vitalization of the solar plexus center, and lastly, the cases of insanity brought about by overstimulation of the brain cells through unwise meditation work, and it will become increasingly clear why it is deemed necessary to proceed slowly and to develop the mental processes as well as the spiritual nature. The average student starts with the knowledge that he has centers and with a desire for purity of character. He is assured by those who know that as he strives, meditates, studies, and serves, certain changes will take place within him, and that there will arise from the depths of his being an awakening which will be dynamic. He is told that there will follow a breathing forth, a stirring and a vitalizing which will bring his subjective spiritual life into prominence. This subjective life expresses itself as spiritual energy through the medium of the energy or vital body, and the energy thus expressed will change his life focus and interests and produce a magnetic and dynamic effect which will attract and lift humanity. This energy is sevenfold in nature and utilizes seven focal points in the etheric body as its agents. It is not possible for the aspirant to work with and utilize all these seven types of energy intelligently in the early stages of the path of discipleship. The emphasis for training purposes is laid upon only three of them. These are, 1, that of will, strength, or power through the medium of the head center. This is the energy of the spiritual man and comes directly from the monad via the soul. Up to the third initiation, however, all that the disciple needs to grasp is that the will aspect of the soul should control the personality via the mental body to the head center. When this is the case, the thousand-petaled lotus begins to function. The line of this stream of force is monad, atma, spiritual will. The inner circle of petals in the egoic lotus, the will petals. The mental body, the head center in the etheric body, the nervous system and brain. 2, that of love wisdom through the medium of the heart center. This center, when awakened, leads to that expansion of consciousness which initiates a man into his group life. He loses the sense of separateness and finally emerges into the full light of realization, a realization of unity with his own indwelling God, with all humanity, with all souls in all forms of nature, and so with the oversoul. This force stream comes likewise from the monad via the soul, and its line is as follows. Monad, buddhi, spiritual love, the intuition. The second circle of petals in the egoic lotus, the love petals. The astral body, the heart center, the bloodstream. In the little evolved man, this force stream simply passes through the heart center direct to the solar plexus and expends its two aspects of vital life and of soul quality, one energizing the bloodstream and the other awakening the solar plexus center. This then becomes the dominant factor in the energy life of the man and the force through which his desire nature expresses itself, until such time as the aspirant brings about the needed transmutation and reorientation of his emotional desire nature. Then the heart awakens into activity, and the life of the solar plexus center becomes subordinated to that of the heart. This is brought about by the development of group interests, by the cultivation of inclusiveness, and the steady loss of interest in the personality and in things separative and selfish. 3. That of active intelligence, or the energy which animates the form aspect and which creates forms in line with the subjective purposes of the presiding intelligence, God or man, human or divine. This also proceeds from the third aspect of the monad, and the line of its contact is monad, manas, spiritual intelligence, the higher mind. The third or outer circle of petals in the egoic lotus, the knowledge petals. The etheric body as a whole, as it pervades the dense physical body. The throat center, the cells of the body. In the little evolved man, as in the case of the second aspect and its unfoldment, the energy simply passes through the throat center and goes directly to the sacral center, and thus brings into activity the generative processes and creative faculties utilized in the reproductive work and sex life of the race. This is a broad and general outline of the three main streams of force or divine energy and their direction. The relationship of the head center to the base of the spine, where lies the sleeping fire, will not be considered here, nor will the function of the solar plexus center as a clearing house for the lower energies be touched upon. I am anxious for the students simply to grasp the general idea and the skeleton of the teaching. Every human being, in the course of time, works his way back on the path of return to one of the three major rays. All have eventually to express intelligent creative faculty, to be animated by divine love, and to bring into functioning activity the will as it works out divine purpose and plan. The first center, which the aspirant seeks consciously to energize and on which he concentrates during the early stages of his novitiate, is the heart center. He has to learn to be group conscious, to be sensitive to group ideals, and to be inclusive in his plans and concepts. He has to learn to love collectively and purely, and not be actuated by personality attraction and the motive of reward. Until there is this awakening in the heart, he cannot be trusted to wield the creative powers of the throat center, for they would be subordinated to self-aggrandizement and ambitions of various kinds. Here it should be noted that none of these unfoldments can ever be approached from the standpoint of complete static passivity or from the angle of an entirely new undertaking. We are in process of evolution. Certain aspects of our four centers are already awakened and functioning in relation to the form aspect, but are not yet expressing soul qualities. We have behind us a long and fruitful past. We are none of us purely selfish or separative. Human society is now cohesive and interdependent. Humanity as a whole has already done much in bringing the heart center into partial activity and in awakening some of the more important aspects of the throat center. The problem with many aspirants today is that of the solar plexus, for it is wide open, actively functioning, and almost fully awakened. The work of transmutation is, however, going on simultaneously, leading, as one might naturally suppose, to a good deal of difficulty and to chaotic conditions. The heart center is also beginning to vibrate, but it is not yet awakened. The throat center is frequently prematurely awakened through the transfer of energy from the sacral center. This is due to several causes, sometimes to spiritual purpose and intent, but more frequently to a negation of the normal sex life owing to economic conditions or to a lack of physical vitality which predisposes to celibacy. This lack of vital force is, in its turn, due to many factors, but primarily to a long heredity producing a degeneracy of the physical body or to enforced celibacy in past lives. This enforced celibacy was very often the result of monasticism and the living of the mystical life. When this creative awakening finds expression through any of the arts, literature, painting, music, or in group organization and executive work, there is no harm wrought, for the energy finds a normal creative outlet. These points should be remembered by the aspirant. He is facing a most complex problem. He enters blindly into a situation which is the result of a long evolutionary process and to which he has not the key. Especially in the early stages and prior to the first initiation is this the case, for he has no knowledge of the history of the past nor any prevision as to the future. He has simply to take his equipment and his opportunity and do the best he can, guided by the age-old rules of Raja Yoga and the light of his own soul. As the heart center is awakened and the throat center swings into creative work, a definite relation is set up and there is an interplay of energy between the two. This activity, in its turn, brings about a response from that aspect of the thousand-petaled lotus, a synthetic lotus, through which the energy always animating the heart and throat centers normally passes. This responsive activity and interaction brings about two results, and these should be most carefully noted. First, the light in the head makes its appearance. A sparking, if I might so express it, is set up between the higher positive overshadowing energy as it is centralized within the form of the thousand-petaled lotus and the steadily heightening vibration of the heart and throat centers, or lotuses. These two lower centers, in their turn, are responding to the energies being lifted and raised from the centers below the diaphragm. Secondly, the center between the eyebrows also begins to make its presence felt, and this significant two-petaled lotus begins to vibrate. It symbolizes the work of at-oneing the soul and the body, the subjective and the objective. In some occult books, it is called the lotus with the 96 petals, but this is only a differentiation dealing with the energies focused in the two petals. It will be noted that the sum total of the force petals in the centers, excluding the two head centers, amount in all to 48 petals. These energies, in their two aspects of physical vital energy and soul qualities, make up the 96 aspects or vibrations of the two petals of the ajna or eyebrow center. It must be remembered also that the word petal only symbolizes an expression of force and its apparent effect in matter. The five centers with their 48 petals are synthesized, therefore, into the two-petaled lotus, and then we have 48 plus 2 equals 50, the number of the perfected personality, for 5 is the number of man, and 10 is that of perfection. Symbolically also, if the sum total of the 48 petals of the five centers is added to the 96 petals of the center between the eyebrows, the number 144 appears. This number signifies the completed work of the 12 creative hierarchies, 12 times 12, and thus the bringing together of the subjective soul and the objective body in perfect union and at-one-ment. This is the consummation. To these figures, 144, add that of the number 1,000, the number of the petals in the lotus of the head center, and you have the number of the saved in the book of Revelations, the 144,000 who can stand before God, for the three ciphers which are found indicate the personality. When man has completed within himself the great work, when the number 144,000 is seen as symbolizing his point of attainment, then he can stand before God, standing now not only before the angel of the presence, but before the very presence itself. The awakening of the centers. The question now arises, how can this awakening and coordination be brought about? What steps must be taken in order to produce this vitalization and the eventual synthetic activity of the three centers? Faced with these questions, the true teacher finds a difficulty. It is not easy to make clear the esoteric and paralleling activities which are the result of character building. So oft the aspirant is anxious to be told some new thing, and when he is told some old truth, so old and so familiar that it fails to call forth a registering response, he feels that the teacher has failed him and so succumbs to a sense of futility and depression. However, this must be met and the questions must be answered. I will state, therefore, the necessary requirements as succinctly as possible, giving them in their sequential order and according to their importance from the standpoint of the average aspirant. Let us then enumerate them in tabulated form, and then we will deal briefly with each point afterwards. 1. Character building, the first and essential requisite. 2. Right motive. 3. Service. 4. Meditation. 5. A technical study of the science of the centers. 6. Breathing exercises. 7. Learning the technique of the will. 8. The development of the power to employ time. 9. The arousing of the Kundalini fire. This last and ninth point will not be considered at this stage of our training. The reason is obvious. Most aspirants are at the stage of the third and fourth points and are just beginning to work at the fifth and sixth. Let us touch briefly upon each of these necessary steps, and let me enjoin upon you the need there is to realize in some measure the responsibility entailed by knowledge. Do you appreciate the fact that if you were making full use of each piece of information given in the course of the training and making it a fact in your experience and were living out in your daily life the teaching so steadily imparted, you would be standing ere now before the portal of initiation? Do you realize that truth has to be wrought out in the texture of daily living before new truth can be safely imparted? 1. Character building. These 9 points are to be studied from their force aspect and not from their ethical or spiritual import. It is the world of force into which the initiate enters, and it is the training he receives as an aspirant that makes such a step possible. Each of us enters life with a certain equipment, the product of past lives of endeavor and of experience. That equipment has in it certain deficiencies or lacks, and is seldom of a balanced nature. One man is too mental, another is too psychic, a third is primarily physical, and still another is too mystical. One man is sensitive, irritable, and impressionable. Another is the reverse of all these qualities. One person is centered in his animal nature or is strictly material in his outlook on life, whilst another is visionary and free from the sins of the flesh. The diversities among men are innumerable, but in each life there is a predominant trend towards which all the energies of his nature turn. Perhaps he is swayed strongly by his physical forces and lives consequently the life of an animal. Or he is swayed by astral energy and lives a potently emotional and psychic life. Perhaps, like so many, he is swayed by 3 types of energy, physical, emotional, and an occasional flow of soul energy. The point to be remembered is that the bodies in which we as souls are functioning constitute primarily energy bodies. They are composed of energy units, atoms in a state of constant flux and movement, and find their place in an environment of a similar nature. Acting as a positive nucleus in these energy bodies, and at present in the majority of cases relatively static, is the soul. It exerts as yet little pressure upon its sheaths and identifies itself with them, thus temporarily negating its own intrinsic life. The day comes, however, when the soul awakens to the need of dominating the situation and of asserting its own authority. Then the man, spasmodically at the beginning, takes stock of the situation. He has to discover first which type of energy preponderates and is the motivating force in his daily experience. Having discovered this, he begins to reorganize, to reorient, and to rebuild his bodies. The whole of this teaching can be summed up in 2 words, vice and virtue. Vice is the energy of the sheaths, individual or synthesized in the personality, as it controls the life activities and subordinates the soul to the sheaths and to the impulses and tendencies of the lower self. Virtue is the calling in of new energies and of a new vibratory rhythm so that the soul becomes the positive controlling factor and the soul forces supersede those of the bodies. This process is that of character building. Let me illustrate. A man is the victim of an irritable and nervous disposition. We say to him that he needs to be calm and peaceful and to cultivate detachment and so gain control of himself. We teach him that in place of a cross disposition, there should be sweetness and calm. This sounds a platitude and most uninteresting. Yet what is really being stated is that in place of the restless, self-centered emotional nature and the activity of the solar plexus center, carrying the powerful forces of the astral plane, there should be imposed the steady, detached, and harmonizing rhythm of the soul, the higher self. This work of imposing the higher vibration on the lower is character building, the first prerequisite upon the path of probation. On reading this, the earnest student can begin to sum up his energy assets. He can tabulate the forces which he feels control his life, and thus arrive at a reasonable and truthful understanding of the forces which require to be subordinated and those which require to be strengthened. Then, in the light of true knowledge, let him go forward upon the path of his destiny. 2. Right motive. The master of the wisdom, we are told, is the rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers. The question which the seeker now asks, and which he only has the right to answer, is, what is the motive governing my aspiration and my endeavor? Why do I seek to build upon a true foundation? Why do I so diligently invoke my soul? The development of right motive is a progressive effort, and constantly one shifts the focus of one's incentive when one discovers himself, as the light shines ever more steadily upon one's way, and constantly a newer and higher motive emerges. Again, let me illustrate. An aspirant, in the early stages, is practically always a devotee. To measure up to the standard set by a loved friend and teacher, he struggles and strives and gains ground. Later, this object of his devotion and ardent effort is superseded by devotion to one of the great ones, the elder brothers of the race. He bends all his powers and the forces of his nature to their service. This incentive is, in its turn, surely and steadily superseded by a vital love for humanity, and love of one individual, be he ever so perfect, is lost sight of in love for the whole brotherhood of men. Unceasingly, as the soul takes more and more control of its instrument and the soul nature steadily manifests, this too is superseded by love of the ideal, of the plan, and of the purposes underlying the universe itself. The man comes to know himself as naught but a channel through which spiritual agencies can work, and realizes himself as a corporate part of the one life. Then he sees even humanity as relative and fractional, and becomes immersed in the great will. 3. Service. A study of right motive leads naturally to right service, and often parallels in its objective form the motivating consciousness. From service to an individual as an expression of love, to the family or to the nation, there grows service to a member of the hierarchy, to a master's group, and thence service to humanity. Eventually, there is developed a consciousness of and service of the plan, and a consecration to the underlying purpose of the great existence who has brought all into being for the fulfillment of some specific objective. 4. Meditation. Upon this matter we will not enlarge, as it has formed the basis of much of the teaching in my other books, and many of you are working steadily upon the work of meditation. I have placed it fourth upon the list, for meditation is dangerous and unprofitable to the man who enters upon it without the basis of a good character and of clean living. Meditation then becomes only a medium for the bringing in of energies which but serve to stimulate the undesirable aspects of his life, just as the fertilizing of a garden full of weeds will produce a stupendous crop of them and so crush out the weak and tiny flowers. Meditation is dangerous where there is wrong motive, such as desire for personal growth and for spiritual powers, for it produces, under these conditions, only a strengthening of the shadows in the veil of illusion, and brings to full growth the serpent of pride lurking in the valley of selfish desire. Meditation is dangerous when the desire to serve is lacking. Service is another word for the utilization of soul force for the good of the group. Where this impulse is lacking, energy may pour into the bodies, but, lacking use and finding no outlet, will tend to overstimulate the centers and produce conditions disastrous to the neophyte. Assimilation and elimination are laws of the soul life as well as of the physical life, and when this simple law is disregarded, serious consequences will follow as inevitably as in the physical body. 5. Study of the centers. This we are now beginning. It is a study as yet in its infancy in the West and little applied in the East. Our approach will be somewhat new, for though we will accustom ourselves to the names, locations, and relationships of the centers, we shall do no meditation work upon them. Eventually, we shall arrive at an appreciation of their vibration, of their tone and colors, and of the astrological significances. We shall not work with the centers down the spinal column, nor aim at their conscious utilization as does the clairvoyant and clairaudient person. All the work done by students must be done entirely in the head and from the head. There is the seat of the will or spirit aspect working through the soul. There also is the synthetic expression of the personality, and in the understanding of the relation of the two head centers and their mutual interplay will come gradually the domination of the personality by the soul. This will lead to the consequent and subsequent guided activity of the five other centers. The work in these five centers will eventually be as automatic as the present functioning of the heart and the lungs in the physical body. The presiding intelligence, the self, seated on the throne between the eyebrows and guided by the light in the head, will be awake to the interests of the soul and as alert as is the eye consciousness of the average self-centered man. By the rhythm of his divine life and by his conscious cooperation with the plan and functioning through the use of the will, must the disciple in incarnation act as the agent of his soul in the three worlds. 6. Breathing exercises. Little by little, as progress is made, will the needed instruction be imparted. Let me point out, however, that no breathing exercises can be safely used where there is no attempt to impose rhythm upon the life of every day. The two activities must go hand in hand. The effect of breathing exercises is varied. A. There is an oxygenating effect. The bloodstream is purified and pressure is relieved. A symbolism underlies this, for as the blood is oxygenated, so is the life of the man in the three worlds permeated by spiritual energy. B. There is the imposition of a peculiar rhythm brought about by the particular spacing and time limit of the breaths, inhalation, retention, and exhalation, and this will vary according to the counts. C. There is a subtle effect of prana, which is a subjective element underlying the air breathed in and out, which affects most potently the body of prana, the vital or etheric body. Students should remember that subtle effects are more powerful than the physical effects. They produce results in two directions, on the physical body and on the etheric body. The entire vital body assumes a particular rhythm according to the breathing exercises. This, kept up for a long period of time, will have a shattering or a cohesive effect upon the physical body and devitalize or vitalize the etheric body correspondingly. D. There is the effect upon the centers which is most effectual and which follows the trend of the aspirant's thought. If, for instance, a man thinks upon the solar plexus, that center will inevitably be vitalized and his emotional nature be strengthened. Hence the need for students to hold their meditation steady in the head and so awaken the head center. Let no one doubt the effect of breathing exercises upon the vital body. As surely as eating and drinking build or destroy the physical body and aid or hinder its right functioning, so do breathing exercises produce potent effects if rightly used over a long enough period of time. And what shall I say about the last three requirements? Nothing much, for the time is not yet ripe for their correct understanding. Step by step must the aspirant proceed, and his theory must not persistently run ahead of his experience. Perhaps I can give the clue to each of these three through the formulation of a simple rule for daily living. This will be grasped by those for whom it is intended and will not work harm to the unevolved. This rule, when followed, will bring about, gently and subjectively, the necessary conditions for the manifestation of the requirement. Learn to use the will through the development of steady purpose and the organizing of the daily life so that that purpose may reach fulfillment. Learn to do something else with time besides organize it and use it. Learn to do several things simultaneously and utilize, therefore, all the three bodies synchronously. Let me illustrate. When you are practicing your daily breathing exercise, keep your count with accuracy. Listen attentively for the sound that soundeth in the silence of the interlude. At the same time, think of yourself as the soul, the imposer of rhythm, and the voice that speaks. This is something which can be acquired by practice by each of you. Discover the serpent of illusion by the help of the serpent of wisdom, and then will the sleeping serpent mount upwards to the place of meeting. Rule 6. The devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. They are driven forth and lose their master. The work of the eye. Rule 6, the work of the eye. We have for consideration now one of the simplest of the rules for magic, yet at the same time one of the most practical, and one upon which the entire success of all magical work depends. I would like to point out to the investigating aspirant that the key to the situation depicted in the rule lies in the word contemplation, found in the preceding one. Let us therefore study that word with care and seek its accurate definition. To contemplate involves steady vision, one pointedly directed towards a specific objective. the soul or solar angel might be regarded as gazing in three directions. One, towards the light supernal, towards that central life or energy which holds hid within itself the purpose and plan towards which all being tends. I know not how to express this more clearly. What that directive force may be, what is the secret of being itself, is only revealed during the more advanced initiations, and is only finally grasped when the causal body itself, the karana sarira, disintegrates and the final limitation slips away. With this direction of the solar angel's vision, we need not concern ourselves. 2. Over the kingdom wherein the solar angel reigns supreme, over the world of souls or egoic impulses, of hierarchical work and of pure thought. This is the kingdom of God, the world of heavenly being. It is the state whereof disciples are becoming increasingly aware, wherein initiates work, and from which the masters in their graded ranks direct the evolutionary process of the planet. These two directions in which the soul looks constitute the world of its spiritual experience and the object of its aspiration. Let it not be forgotten that the spiritual man, the solar angel, has also his goal of endeavor, and that his becomes the predominant impulse once the subjugation of the vehicle in the three worlds is brought about. Just as the fully intelligent human being can only begin consciously to function as a soul and to contact the kingdom of the soul, so only the fully active and dominant soul, in which the Buddhic principle is potentially controlling, can begin to contact the state of pure being in which the monad, or spirit, eternally rests. The development of the intellect in man marks its fitness for the work of treading the path back to full soul consciousness. The development of the Buddhic or wisdom love aspect in the solar angel demonstrates his fitness for further progression in the awareness of the state of pure being. 3. The third direction in which the soul looks and wherein he exercises the faculty of contemplative vision is towards his reflection in the three worlds. The object of the long struggle between the higher and the lower man has been to make the lower responsive to and sensitively aware of the forces emanating from the soul as the soul contemplates his triple instrument. There is an interesting relation between these three directions of contemplation and the awakening in the three major centers. This cannot be more than hinted at owing to the abstruseness of the subject. So many factors govern this awakening, and each aspirant has to determine for himself the order and mode of his awakening. The center between the eyebrows, commonly called the third eye, has a unique and peculiar function. As I have pointed out elsewhere, students must not confound the pineal gland with the third eye. They are related, but not the same. In the secret doctrine, they are apparently regarded as the same, and the casual reader can easily confound them, but they are by no means identical. This HPB knew, but the apparent confusion was permitted until more of the etheric nature of forms was known. The third eye manifests as a result of the vibratory interaction between the forces of the soul, working through the pineal gland, and the forces of the personality, working through the pituitary body. These negative and positive forces interact, and when potent enough, produce the light in the head. Just as the physical eye came into being in response to the light of the sun, so the spiritual eye equally comes into being in response to the light of the spiritual sun. As the aspirant develops, he becomes aware of the light. I refer to the light in all forms, veiled by all sheaths and expressions of the divine life, and not just to the light within the aspirant himself. As his awareness of this light increases, so does the apparatus of vision develop, and the mechanism whereby he can see things in the spiritual light comes into being in the etheric body. This is the eye of Shiva, for it is only fully utilized in the magical work when the monadic aspect, the will aspect, is controlling. By means of the third eye, the soul accomplishes three activities. 1. It is the eye of vision. By its means, the spiritual man sees behind the forms of all aspects of divine expression. He becomes aware of the light of the world and contacts the soul within all forms. Just as the physical eye registers forms, so does the spiritual eye register the illumination within those forms, which illumination indicates a specific state of being. It opens up the world of radiance. True, it is the controlling factor of the magical work. All white magical work is carried forward with a definitely constructive purpose made possible through the use of the intelligent will. In other words, the soul knows the plan, and when the alignment is right and the attitude correct, the will aspect of the divine man can function and bring about results in the three worlds. The organ used is the third eye. The analogy to this can be seen in the often noticed power of the human eye as it controls other human beings and animals by a look, and through steady gazing can act magnetically. Force flows through the focused human eye. Force flows through the focused third eye. 3. It has a destructive aspect, and the energy flowing through the third eye can have a disintegrating and destroying effect. It can, through its focused attention, directed by the intelligent will, drive out physical matter. It is the agent of the soul in the purificatory work. It should be noted here that in each of the subtle bodies in the three worlds, there is a corresponding point of focus, and the center between the eyebrows is but the physical counterpart, for etheric matter is physical, of inner correspondences. Through this point of focus, the soul looks out upon or contemplates the mental plane, including the mental mechanism. Similarly, on the emotional plane, the soul is brought into a state of awareness or vision of its emotional sheath and the world of astral phenomena, and the physical parallel exists for the etheric body. It is this third work of the soul that is touched upon here, the destructive work of getting rid of the old forms, of shaking out of the bodies matter of an undesirable nature, and of breaking down the barriers and limitations to true soul activity. These three activities of the soul, through the medium of the third eye, are the correspondences to the three aspects, and students would find it of interest to work these out. The seeing of the light within all forms through the agency of the third eye, brought into being through the realization of the light in the head, the spiritual light, is but the correspondence to the physical eye revealing forms in the light of the physical sun. This corresponds to the personality. The aspect of control through magnetic energy and the attractive force in the spiritual eye, which is the dominant factor in magical work, is the correspondence to the soul. In the most mysterious sense, the soul is the eye of the monad, enabling the monad, which is pure being, to work, to contact, to know, and to see. The aspect of destruction is the correspondence to the monad or will aspect. In the last analysis, it is the monad that brings about the final abstraction, destroys all forms, withdraws itself from manifestation, and ends the cycle of creative work. Bringing these concepts down to practical expression in relation to the rule under consideration, it can be noted that all these three activities are dealt with in this rule. The third eye opens as the result of conscious development, right alignment, and the inflow of soul life. Then its magnetic controlling force makes itself felt, controlling the lives of the lower bodies, driving forth the lower four elementals of earth, water, fire, air, and forcing the lunar lords to abdicate. The personality, which has hitherto been the master, no longer can control, and the soul comes into full domination in the three worlds. The elemental of earth, which is the sum total of the many lives which form the physical body, is controlled and feels the eye of the master, the one master in the head, upon it. The gross elements constituting that body are driven forth, and better and more adequate atoms or lives are built in. The elemental of the astral or body of water undergoes a similar activity, plus a stabilizing effect which brings to an end the restlessness and fluidic tempestuousness which have hitherto characterized it. Through the controlling magnetic power of the spiritual eye, the soul rebuilds the astral body and holds it steady and coherent through its focused attention. Again, an analogous process goes forward in the mental body. Old forms disappear before the clear light in which the spiritual man is working, and as the old commentary puts it, quote, "One glance the soul doth cast upon the forms of mind, a ray of light streams out, and darkness disappears. distortions and evil forms fade out, and all the little fires die out. The lesser lights are no more seen. The eye, through light, awakens into life the needed modes of being. To the disciple, this will carry knowledge. To the ignorant, no sense is seen, for a sense lacks. Close quote. The elemental of the air, symbolically understood, is that substratum of energy which works through the forms of the etheric body, which is dealt with through the breath and handled through the science of pranayama. This elemental form is the intricate etheric structure, the nadis and centers, and all advanced students know well how these are controlled by the focused attention of the soul in contemplation, acting through the head center, focused in the region of the third eye, and swept into right and specific activity by an act of the will. In the above sentence, I have concentrated the formula for all magical work on the physical plane. It is through the etheric body and the force, directed through one or other of the centers, that the soul carries on the work in magic. It is through the intense focusing of intention in the head and the turning of the attention through the third eye towards the center to be used that the force finds its correct outlet. That force is made potent by the energizing, directed, intelligent will. Study these points, for in them you will find the clue to the magical work in your own life reconstruction, to the magical work of human reconstruction which certain adepts are carrying on, and to the magical work of the evolution of the divine plan which is the motivating power of the occult hierarchy. Rule 7. The dual forces on the plane, whereon the vital power must be sought, are seen. The two paths face the solar angel. The poles vibrate. A choice confronts the one who meditates. The battleground of the astral plane, the two paths. Rule 7. The battleground of the astral plane. We must start our study and consideration of the seventh rule for magic. We have completed the first six rules, which deal specifically with work on the mental plane, and hence have a practical value only for those who are beginning to utilize the power of the mind in the magical work of creation. It is interesting to note in this connection that, as humanity enters into its heritage of mind, there appears simultaneously a growing tendency towards magical work. Schools of affirmation are cropping up on all sides, whose announced intent is to create those natural conditions wherein a man may have what he deems to be admirable and advisable. Books on the subject of the creative mind are flooding the markets, and discussions on the force back of the creative arts are deemed of vital interest. Psychologists are giving the entire matter much consideration, and though at present the ideal is viewed almost entirely in terms of the physical plane, yet the sum total indicates a vibratory activity in the world soul, as it expresses itself through humanity and issues forth from the mental realm. The pioneers of the race and the foremost thinkers and creative workers of humanity are but the sensitives who respond most readily to the mental impulses. They are in the minority as yet, and most people respond to the forces and vibrations emanating from the plane of the emotions and of desire. More and more, however, are awakening, and the significance of the six first rules of magic will become increasingly apparent. These 15 rules are divided into 6 rules on the mental plane, 5 rules on the desire or astral plane, 4 rules on the physical plane. The main thought to be held clearly in the mind is that they confine themselves to the use of energy in the three worlds, and that this energy is either consciously manipulated by the governing soul or is swept into activity by the force inherent in the matter of the three worlds independently of the soul. When this is the case, the man is a victim of his own form energies and the matter aspect of all manifestation. In the other case, he is the intelligent ruler, controller of his own destinies, and swings the lower energies into forms and activities through the power of his mind impulses and the focused attention of his own soul. In the 6 rules already considered, 1 or 2 thoughts most clearly emerge and might be summed up in the following terms. Rule 1, recollection, resulting in concentration. Rule 2, response, resulting in an interaction between higher and lower. Rule 3, radiation resulting in a sounding fourth. Rule 4, respiration resulting in creative work. Rule 5, reunion resulting in the at-one-ment. Rule 6, reorientation resulting in a clear vision of the plan. Students would do well to consider these relationships and to work out the underlying synthesis. In the words of this rule, the astral plane, with its function and problem, is ably synthesized. Note the terms used in the description given in a few short phrases. 1. The plane of dual forces. 2. The plane of the two paths. 3. The plane whereon the vital power is sought. 4. The plane of the vibrating poles. 5. The plane whereon a choice is made. One of the most vital things every aspirant has to do is to learn to understand the astral plane, to comprehend its nature, and to learn both to stand free from it and then to work on it. In this instruction, I seek to give some clear teaching on this plane, for the moment a man can see on the astral plane and can achieve equilibrium and hold steady in the midst of its vibrating forces, that moment he is ready for initiation. First, let us gather together some of the terms which are used to describe this sphere of divine being wherewith a man has first to identify himself, penetrate to the center, pierce through its veiled illusion, and eventually stand poised, untouched, detached, uninfluenced, and free. The term astral, so often used, is in reality a misnomer. H.P.B. was basically right when she used the term in connection with the etheric or vital planes of the physical plane. When contact is made with the etheric world, the first impression given is always of a starry light, of brilliance, of scintillation. Gradually, however, the word became identified with karma or desire, and so was used for the plane of emotional reaction. It is interesting to note this, for it is in itself an instance of the effect of the astral plane upon the human brain, which in its uninformed condition reverses the reality and sees things in an upside-down state. The appearance of the astral plane, when first definitely seen by the opened eye of the aspirant, is one of dense fog, confusion, changing forms, interpenetrating and intermingling colors, and is of such a kaleidoscopic appearance that the hopelessness of the enterprise seems overwhelming. It is not light or starry or clear. It is apparently impenetrable disorder, for it is the meeting ground of forces. Because the forces in the aspirant's own body are equally in disorder, he blends in with the surrounding chaos to such an extent that it is at first almost impossible for the onlooking soul to dissociate its own astral mechanism from the astral mechanism of humanity as a whole and from the astral mechanism of the world. One of the first things, then, that the aspirant has to learn is to dissociate his own aura, in the emotional sense, from that of his surroundings, and much time is expended in learning to do this. It is for this reason that one of the first qualifications of discipleship is discrimination, for it is through the use of the mind, as analyzer and separator, that the astral body is brought under control. Secondly, the astral plane is the plane of illusion, of glamour, and of a distorted presentation of reality. The reason for this is that every individual in the world is busy working in astral matter, and the potency of human desire and of world desire produces that constant out-picturing and form-building which leads to the most concrete effects of astral matter. Individual desire, national desire, racial desire, the desire of humanity as a whole, plus the instinctual desire of all subhuman lives, causes a constant changing and shifting of the substance of the plane. There is a building of the temporary forms, some of rare beauty, some of no beauty, and a vitalizing by the astral energy of its creator. Add to these forms that persistent and steadily growing scenario we call the Akashic Records, which concern the emotional history of the past. add the activities of the discarnate lives which are passing through the astral plane, either out of or towards incarnation, add the potent desire, purified and intelligent, of all superhuman lives, including those of the occult planetary hierarchy, and the sum total of forces present is stupendous. All play upon, around, and through every human being, and according to the caliber of his physical body and the condition of his centers, will be his response. Through this illusory panorama, the aspirant has to make his way, finding the clue or thread which will lead him out of the maze, and holding fast to each tiny fragment of reality as it presents itself to him, learning to distinguish truth from glamour, the permanent from the impermanent, and the certainty from the unreal. As the old commentary puts it, quote, "Let the disciple seize hold of the tail of the serpent of wisdom, and having with firmness grasped it, let him follow it into the deepest center of the hall of wisdom. Let him not be betrayed into the trap set for him by the serpent of illusion, but let him shut his eyes to the colorful tracery upon its back, and his ears to the melody of its voice. Let him discern the jewel set in the forehead of the serpent whose tail he holds, and by its radiance traverse the miry holes of Maya." Close quote. No glamour, no illusion can long hold the man who has set himself the task of treading the razor-edged path which leads through the wilderness, through the thick-set forest, through the deep waters of sorrow and distress, through the valley of sacrifice and over the mountains of vision to the gate of deliverance. He may travel sometimes in the dark, and the illusion of darkness is very real. He may travel sometimes in a light so dazzling and bewildering that he can scarcely see the way ahead. He may know what it is to falter on the path and to drop under the fatigue of service and of strife. He may be temporarily sidetracked and wander down the bypaths of ambition, of self-interest, and of material enchantment, but the lapse will be but brief. Nothing in heaven or hell, on earth or elsewhere, can prevent the progress of the man who has awakened to the illusion, who has glimpsed the reality beyond the glamour of the astral plane, and who has heard, even if only once, the clarion call of his own soul. The astral plane is also the Kurukshetra, both of humanity as a whole and of the individual human unit. It is the battleground whereon must be found the Waterloo of every aspirant. In some one life, there comes an emotional crisis in which decisive action is taken, and the disciple proves his control of his emotional nature. This may take the form of some great and vital test, covering a brief time but calling forth every resource of wisdom and of purity that the disciple possesses, or it may be a long and protracted emotional strain carried over many years of living. But in the attaining of success and in the achievement of clear vision and right discernment through right discrimination, the disciple testifies to his fitness for the second initiation. I would like to point out that it is this test and crisis through which humanity is now passing, and which began in those conditions which culminated in the World War and the present world strain. The first initiation of humanity as an entity took place when individualization became possible and the soul was born in the body of humanity. This was preceded by a period of fearful stress and strain, dimly sensed by the pioneers into the human kingdom from the ranks of the animal men. Should this crisis be successfully passed, the second initiation of humanity will be the result, the passing through the baptism and the entering of the stream. So the World War and its resulting effects constitute the Kurukshetra of the world Arjuna, and the outcome is still in the balance. Let this not be forgotten. There is, however, no cause for pessimism. The outcome of good is inevitable. It is, however, a question of a slow or a rapid realization and liberation from the great world illusion, and to this end every aspirant is begged to work strenuously and to lend his aid. Every man who liberates himself, who sees clearly, and who releases himself from the glamour of illusion, aids in the great work. Again, the astral plane is that whereon the pairs of opposites act and interact, and whereon the pull of the great dualities is most potently felt. Primarily, the interaction is between the soul and its vehicle, matter. But there are many lesser dualities which play their part and are more easily recognized by the average man. Light and darkness interact as do pleasure and pain. Good and evil meet and form the playground of the gods, and poverty and riches are offset one against the other. The entire modern economic situation is of an astral nature. It is the outcome of desire and the result of a certain selfish use of the forces of matter. Heat and cold, as we understand the term, in a most peculiar manner, are the result of the interplay of the pairs of opposites, and an interesting line of occult study concerns itself with the effects of racial emotions on climatic conditions. We most truly make our climate in one significant sense. When desire has burnt itself out, planetary life comes to an end, as climatic conditions will negate form life as we understand it. In relation to the human unit, the secret of liberation lies in the balancing of the forces and the equilibrizing of the pairs of opposites. The path is the narrow line between these pairs which the aspirant finds and treads, turning neither to the right nor to the left. It must be remembered always that when the pairs of opposites are discerned, when a man balances the forces of his own nature, when he has found the path and become the path, then he can work with the world forces, can preserve the balance and the equilibrium of the energies of the three worlds, and so become a co-worker with the masters of the wisdom. Let us pray and hope that this may be the practical outcome of our understanding of the nature of the battleground of the astral plane. The two paths. Passing from our consideration of the nature of the astral plane, we will deal with its functions and the relation of the disciple to its activities. Let us remember certain things about it. First, it is preeminently the battleground, and on it is fought the warfare which eventuates in the final release of the imprisoned soul. It is useful to have in mind the outstanding characteristics of the three planes and the three bodies which function on them. The physical plane is the plane of active experience in and through matter. It is the plane of externalization, and according to the condition and point of development of the inner man, so will be the outer form and its activities. The astral plane is the plane whereon the man passes through three stages of consciousness. A. He gains, through his sensory apparatus, consciousness in the world of forms, and develops ability to react to those forms with wisdom and intelligence. This consciousness he shares with the animal world, though he goes far beyond them in some respects, owing to his possession of a correlating and coordinating mind. B. Sensitivity, or awareness of moods, emotions, and feelings, desires and aspirations which have their roots within him in the principle of self-consciousness, or in the Ahamkara principle, as the occultist who loves difficult phrases is apt to call it. This he shares in common with his fellow men. C. Spiritual awareness or sensitiveness to the spiritual world and the feeling aspect of the higher consciousness. This has its roots in the soul, presupposes the dominance of the mental nature, and is that faculty which constitutes him a mystic. This awareness he shares in common with all disciples, and it is the reward of the gained victories of his astral plane experience. The mental plane comes next. In it, the right use of the intellect is the outstanding achievement. This is also characterized by three stages. A. The stage wherein the mind is the receiver of impressions from the outer world via the five senses and the brain. This is a negative condition, and in it, the modifications of the thinking principle are brought about through the impacts of the external world and the reactions of the astral world. B. The stage wherein the mind initiates its own activities and wherein the intellect is a dominating factor. Though thrown into activity by the factors enumerated above, it is responsive also to the thought currents of the mental plane as well, and becomes exceedingly active as the result of these two contacts. Out of these, a third activity supervenes, wherein the reasoning principle acts upon the information gained in these two ways, sets its own streams of thoughts, and formulates its own thought forms, as well as registering those of others. C. The stage wherein the soul, through concentration and meditation, succeeds in imposing its ideas and impressions upon the mind held steady in the light, and so enables the mental body to respond to impressions and contacts emanating from the subjective and spiritual worlds. Yet the battle, par excellence, is fought out in the astral body and only reaches its most intense point and its potent fierceness when there is a good physical instrument and a well-equipped mentality. The greater the sensitivity of the astral body, the greater its reactions to the physical world and to the mental condition, and hence the fact emerges that disciples and the more highly evolved people in the world have a more potent astral body and work under greater emotional strain than the less highly evolved and the liberated sons of God. Students are therefore begged to deal drastically and potently with their emotional natures, remembering that victory descends from above and cannot be worked up to from below. The soul must govern, and its instrument in the warfare is the consecrated mind. It is interesting to note the occult sequence in the description given of this plane in the rule under consideration. It is, first of all, the plane of dual forces. The first thing the aspirant becomes aware of is duality. The little evolved man is aware of synthesis, but it is the synthesis of his material nature. The highly spiritual man is aware also of synthesis, but it is that in his soul, whose consciousness is that of unity. But in between is the wretched aspirant, conscious of duality above all else, and pulled hither and thither between the two. His first step has for its objective to make him aware of the pairs of opposites and of the necessity to choose between them. Through the light which he has discovered in himself, he becomes aware of the dark. Through the good which attracts him, he sees the evil which is for him the line of least resistance. Through the activity of pain, he can visualize and become aware of pleasure, and heaven and hell become to him realities. Through the activity of the attractive life of his soul, he realizes the attraction of matter and of form, and is forced to recognize the urge and pull of both of them. He learns to feel himself as pendant twixt the two great forces, and once the dualities are grasped, it dawns on him slowly and surely that the deciding factor in the struggle is his divine will, in contradistinction to his selfish will. Thus the dual forces play their part until they are seen as two great streams of divine energy, pulling in opposite directions, and he becomes then aware of the two paths mentioned in our rule. One path leads back into the dreary land of rebirth, and the other leads through the golden gate to the city of free souls. One is therefore involutionary and involves him in deepest matter. The other leads him out of the body nature and makes him eventually aware of his spiritual body, through which he can function in the kingdom of the soul. One path, later on, when he is a true and pledged chela, is known to him as the left-hand path, and the other the path of right activity. On one path, he becomes proficient in black magic, which is only the developed powers of the personality subordinated to the selfish purposes of a man whose motives are those of self-interest and worldly ambition. These confine him to the three worlds and shut the door which opens on to life. On the other path, he subordinates his personality and exercises the magic of the White Brotherhood, working always in the light of the soul, with the soul in all forms, and laying no emphasis upon the ambitions of the personal self. Clear discrimination of these two paths reveals what is called in some occult books that narrow, razor-edged path which lies between the two. This is the noble middle path of the Buddha and marks the fine line of demarcation between the pairs of opposites and between the two streams which he has learnt to recognize, one going up unto the gates of heaven and the other passing down into the nethermost hell. By the exercise of the two main weapons of the aspirant, discrimination and dispassion, he gains that quality which is called in this rule the vital power. Just as the eye is the instrument of choice in choosing the way of travel on the physical plane and has besides a potency all its own whereby it attracts and develops its own sign language, so a vital power is felt in the aspirant. This eventually brings the third eye into activity, and so there is gained a potency and a clear vision which make right choice and quick progress upon the way a steady progression. We are told that power is grown or developed in silence, and only he who can find a center of peace within his head, where the paths of the bodily forces and the spiritual inflowing tides meet, can rightly practice true discrimination and that dispassion which bring the controlled astral and mental bodies under the guidance of the soul.
Then he can understand the significance of the vibrating poles and achieve that point of equilibrium which is the result of their interaction and vibration. The sensing of the dual forces and the clear discrimination of the two paths leads to the development of the vital power. This vital power demonstrates its first activity in enabling the aspirant to achieve a point of balance and so stand on that pinnacle of achievement whereon a choice is made. What is that choice? For the aspirant, it is that between rapid and slow progress. For the disciple, accepted and loyal, it is the choice between methods of service. For the initiate, it oft lies betwixt spiritual advancement and the arduous work of staying with the group and working out the plan. For the master, it is the choice between the seven paths, and it will therefore be apparent how much more strenuous and difficult is his problem. All, however, prepares the aspirant for right choice through right discrimination, leading to right action, and made possible through practiced dispassion. In this sentence is summed up the technique of the warrior upon the battlefield of the desire plane. It should here be noted that in the steadily developing power of choice and the loyally fought battle of the astral plane, the consciousness in the man shifts stage by stage. First, it is the battered, earth-weary aspirant who has to struggle with desire, with glamour, with ambition, and with his sensitive emotional body. He thinks the battle is stupendous, but from the wider angle it is relatively small, yet all that he can stand. Later, it is the experienced probationary disciple who wrestles in the veil of illusion and deals not alone with his own nature, but with the forces of that veil also, recognizing its dual nature. Then the disciple comes forth to battle and faces with courage, and often with clear vision, the forces arrayed against him. They involve not only those in his own nature and in those aspects of the astral plane to which he naturally reacts, but also involve the forces of illusion arrayed against the group of disciples to which he belongs. Let all disciples take note of this and have it in mind in these difficult and strenuous days. Such disciples are in conscious contact at times with their soul forces, and for them there is no defeat nor turning back. They are the tried warriors, scarred and tired, yet knowing that triumphant victory lies ahead, for the soul is omnipotent. Accepted disciples who battle all the above enumerated factors, plus the black forces arrayed against the elder brothers, can call upon the spiritual energies of their group, and, at rare and indicated moments, upon the master under whom they work. Thus the work and labor expands, thus the responsibility and struggle steadily increases, yet at the same time there is also a steadily growing recognition of potencies which can be contacted and utilized, and which, when correctly contacted, ensure victory at the end. The phrase, "the one who meditates," relates to the soul. Arjuna, the aspiring disciple, resigns the struggle and hands the weapons and the reins of government to Krishna, the soul, and is rewarded at last by understanding and by a vision of the divine form which veils the Son of God, who is himself. When this battle has been fought and won, the disciple steps into the ranks of the white magicians of our planet and can wield forces, cooperate with the plan, command the elementals, and bring order out of chaos. He is no longer immersed in the world illusion, but has risen above it. He can no longer be held down by the chains of his own past habits and his karma. He has gained the vital power and stands forth an elder brother. Such is the path ahead of each and all who dare to tread it. Such is the opportunity offered to all students who have made their choice with dispassion and are prompted by love and the desire to serve. Rule 8. The Agni Suryans respond to the sound. The waters ebb and flow. Let the magician guard himself from drowning at the point where land and water meet. The midway spot, which is neither dry nor wet, must provide the standing place whereon his feet are set. When water, land, and air meet, there is the place for magic to be wrought. Types of astral force. Cyclic ebb and flow. Rule 8. Types of astral force. It would be advisable for the student to read with care the commentary on this rule as given in the treatise on cosmic fire. It will be noted how extremely abstruse it is, and how full of almost blind occult information. This should, however, be studied. The word astral plane should also be looked up, and a general idea gained as to its nature and its function as the battleground of the senses, and as the place from which magic is wrought. The intelligent and constructive desire of the white magician, acting under the instruction of his own soul, and therefore occupied with group work, is the motivating power back of all magical phenomena. This magical work is begun in the magician's own life, extends to the world of the astral plane, and from thence, when potent there, can begin to demonstrate on the physical plane and on the higher planes eventually. We shall therefore take a good deal of time over this rule, for it covers the immediate work and activity of the intelligent aspirant. It is the most important in the book from the standpoint of the average student. It cannot be understood where there is no soul contact, nor can the magical force of the soul work out in manifestation upon the physical plane until the meaning of its esoteric phrases has been somewhat wrought out in the inner experience of the magician. Most true aspirants are now at the midway spot, and can either drown, and so make no further progress this life, stand, and so hold the ground gained, or become true practicing magicians, efficient in white magic, which is based on love, animated by wisdom, and intelligently applied to forms. We will therefore divide this rule into several parts, the more easily to study it, and take them up step by step so as to grasp their application to the average life of the probationary disciple and to gain a wise understanding of their wide implications. These three divisions are: 1. The response of the astral elementals and the consequent ebb and flow of the waters. 2. The dangers of the midway spot, its nature, and the opportunity it affords. 3. The place where magic is wrought. We will study now the first point, which is summed up for us in the words, "The Agnisurians respond to the sound, the waters ebb and flow." The situation might be stated in the following terse statements. The rules already studied convey the truth anent the magician. 1. The soul has communicated with his instrument in the three worlds. 2. The man on the physical plane recognizes the contact, and the light in the head shines forth, sometimes recognized and sometimes unrecognized by the aspirant. 3. The soul sounds forth its note. A thought form is created in consonance with the united meditation of the soul and the man, his instrument. 4. This thought form, embodying the will of the ego, or soul, cooperating with the personality, takes to itself a triple form, constituted of the matter of all three planes, and vitalized through the activity and by the emanations from the heart, throat, and ajna centers of the white magician, the soul, in conjunction with its instrument. 5. The personality sheaths, each with its own individual life, feel they are losing their power, and the battle between the forces of matter and the force of the soul is violently renewed. 6. This battle must be fought out on the astral plane, and will decide three things. A. Whether the soul will, in any one life, for some life holds the critical stage, be the dominant factor, and the personality from henceforth be the servant of the soul. B. Whether the astral plane is no longer the plane of illusion, but can become the field of service. C. Whether the man can become an active cooperator with the hierarchy, able to create and to wield mental matter, and so work out the purposes of the universal mind, which are prompted by boundless and infinite love, and are the expression of the one life. There is the crux of the entire situation, and when the man has mastered the forces opposed to him, he is ready for the second initiation, which marks the release of the soul from the prison of the astral body. Henceforth, the soul will use the astral body and mold desire into line with divine purpose. It is of value for the student to know where he stands and what his particular problem is. The average man is learning the control of the physical body and the organizing of his physical plane life. The student on the probationary path is learning a similar lesson in relation to his astral body, its focus, its desires, and its work. The student on the path of accepted discipleship has to demonstrate this control and begin to discipline the mind nature and so function consciously in the mental body. The work of the initiate and the adept grows out of these achievements, and they need not be dealt with here. The battle is spread over quite a series of lives, but in some one life it becomes critical. The final stand is made, and Arjuna triumphs in the fight, but only by letting Krishna assume the reins of control, by learning mind control, and by the revelation of the form of God. By distinguishing between the soul and the form, and by a vision of the perfection of the glory which can radiate from the forms indwelt by God, he learns to choose the way of light, and to see his form and all forms as custodians of the light. So he buckles down to the work of making the astral body simply a reflector of that light, and by the quelling of desire through the subjugation of the Agni Suryans, who constitute his astral body and are the living substance of the astral plane, he learns to function as an adept on that plane, to pierce through its illusion and to see life true. Speaking symbolically, the substance of the astral plane is animated by three types of divine force, which, when brought together, produce the great illusion. These are, first, the force of selfish desire. This involutionary energy plays a big part in bringing about evolution, for selfishness is the nursery of infant souls. Hence, the aspirant refuses to be held by it. Second, the force of fear. This is the product of ignorance, and in its initial stages it is not the product of wrong thinking. It is basically instinctual and is found dominating in the non-mental animal kingdom as well as in the human kingdom. But in the human, its power is increased potently through the powers of the mind and through memory of past pain and grievance and through anticipation of those we foresee. The power of fear is enormously aggravated by the thought form we ourselves have built of our own individual fears and phobias. This thought form grows in power as we pay attention to it, for energy follows thought, till we become dominated by it. Second-rate people are peculiarly a prey to this. For the majority of them, it constitutes the dweller on the threshold. Just as ambition and love of power, backed by frantic desire and unscrupulousness, form the dweller for the first-rate types. The crystallized thought form of intellectual achievement for selfish ends and the use of knowledge for personality objectives stand before the portal of the path in the case of the third-ray person, and unless broken up and destroyed, will dominate him and turn him into a black magician. You have often been told that fear is an illusion, yet this statement does not help. It is a generalization that one can admit, yet which remains profoundly difficult to apply individually. The fears to which aspirants are subject, note the mode of wording this, are seldom of a selfish nature except insofar as suffering has caused them to recoil from a further continuation of untoward happenings. Their fears are wrapped in seeming love around their loved ones, yet should each disciple ask himself a most practical question, how many of the torturing hours have been expended on realities and on tangible happenings, and how many on illusory premonitions and on doubts and questionings based on that which has never happened? I would like to point out to my brothers that they need to do two things. To meditate on truth in daily life, using the concept of truth practiced and lived by as their seed thought in meditation. To this end, I would suggest that they memorize and use at all times, when swept by illusory fears and needless foreboding, the following formula or prayer. Quote, let reality govern my every thought, and truth be the master of my life. Close quote. Let each say this to himself as constantly as need requires, forcing his mind to focus attention upon the significance of these spoken words. I would suggest also sound common sense and the cultivation of an attitude of mind which refuses to permit time for illusory fears to grow. Fear is the main obstacle frequently to a very vital step forward which could be taken in this life, but may have to be delayed to another if due opportunity is not taken and the will nature powerfully excited. The first ray aspirant who fails to overcome his dweller may become a destroyer of souls, as it is called, and be condemned, until he learns his lesson, to work in the forces of matter and with the forms which hold all souls in prison. This is the occult significance of the misunderstood words death and destruction. Of this type, the devil is the great prototype. The second ray aspirant who builds his dweller and permits its steady and increasing control becomes a deluder of souls. He is a true antichrist, and through false teaching and the working of so-called miracles, through hypnotism and mass suggestion, he draws a veil over the world and forces men to walk in the great illusion.